ascoltando i podcast di Radio Bue, la web radio degli studenti dell'Università di Padova, www.radiobue.it.
Hello there, and welcome to Short Science, your 80s-themed portal for all the very best science in brief. I'm Elizabeth Hawke.
And I'm Emma Berger. Coming up on today's show, the latest science and health stories in news in brief. I'll be looking at the science of snow in Capsule Science, and in Capsule Medicine, Elizabeth will be looking at the impact of all this cold weather on our bodies.
Now, we've also got our guest science capsule this week to be filled by Connor Walsh. Now, he's an independent radio producer who's going to be telling us about his new health radio show.
All that will be coming up on today's show, along with a brand new quiz and some pub-style trivia for you to fathom out at home.
This is Short Science.
So, what with all this cold weather we've been having, we thought we'd take a quick look at the science behind the snow.
And how we can best prepare our bodies for these cold conditions. Now, by the end of the show today, hopefully we'll all be a little bit more clued in about how the snow gets here and how we can keep ourselves moving despite the terrible conditions.
Now, frequent listeners will know all about our fantastic website. The address is www.shortscience.co.uk. If you've never checked it out, it's worth a look, if only for the fabulous 80s stylings.
But stylings aside, there's also a lot of useful information to be found there. Now, you can find out what's coming up on the show. You can listen again to a show you might have missed or really liked. And you can subscribe to the podcast or listen online. That's all on our handy podcast page.
Plus, you can send in your profile for everyone to take a look at and even have your very own capsule science to tell people about your science.
Now, we're very interested in what you think about science, about short science, about good science, bad science. In fact, we're just interested to hear from you. So send us an email to studio@shortscience.co.uk for a mention on the show, or if there's a question that we can answer for you. And you can also use the email to request a capsule science or medicine topic, or volunteer to be a guest on the show.
Now, before we get going with the show, there's just one more thing to mention.
That's right. Now, every week we're going to be telling you about a science-related event happening either locally or slightly further afield.
So what's this week's event then?
Well, it's actually for next week, and that's to give everyone a bit of time to get it in the diary. And it's the next in the series of Big Questions debates. Now, these are organised by the Astrophysics Department here at Imperial College. The events have become mighty popular over the last 6 months or so.
That is right. And the events are free, but due to the huge demand, you have to book a place. So, Elizabeth, what's the debate on this time?
It's on the Arabic roots of modern astronomy. Now, it'll be Professor Jill Al-Khalili from the University of Surrey taking on Dr. Rim Turkmani from Imperial College, and they will be discussing how Arab science spearheaded the scientific revolution. And all this will be chaired by Alison Boyle.
Okay, so when and where is all this happening?
Well, then, they've become so popular now, they're being held at the Dana Centre here in South Kensington. This one's on Thursday the 21st of January from 7 till 9 p.m. Now, all the details can be found on the Dana Centre website, which is www.danacentre.org.uk, or on our own website at www.shortscience.co.uk. Now it's time for this week's Science News in Brief.
Moon was magma once.
A new meaning to skin-tight jeans.
Artificial leaves could produce green energy.
Circumcision may change penile flora for the better.
Wow, so my first story is about giant areas of crystal rich in minerals called plagioclases that have been found on the moon by India's Chandrayaan 1 probe. This provides extra evidence for the theory that the moon was formed from debris of a collision between Earth and another planet-sized object.
How are the crystals evidence of that then?
Well, if the collision did happen, the heat would have created a sea of magma which would form the mantle and the crust of the moon. However, this would mean that heavier iron-rich minerals would sink down, because they're heavier, to form the mantle, while iron-poor plagioclases would rise and they would form the crust.
So the discovery of these plagioclases on the surface of the moon reinforces this theory.
Exactly. And they have those crystals which would have cooled from the magma, and they're extremely pure.
Interesting stuff. Well, my first health story today is the news that scientists are developing ways to deliver gene therapy Through the skin.
Through the skin. So how would gene therapy normally be delivered?
Well, often through injections, but this is a really cool technique. Now, John Vogel and his team at the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda, Maryland, grew skin cells that had a gene implanted in them to produce a blood pressure-lowering hormone normally released in the heart. Now, they then grew these skin cells into layers just like normal skin.
So that's like a skin transplant with hidden benefits.
Exactly. Now, they've only worked with mice so far, but they've transplanted these skin patches onto the backs of mice and then monitored their levels of this hormone called ANP, or atrial natriuretic peptide.
And what happened?
Well, the skin cells started producing ANP and the mice had decreased blood pressure. But what's more, their blood pressure stayed low even when they were introduced to risk factors for high blood pressure, like a high salt diet.
Wow, amazing stuff. And that could have some interesting clinical applications. So my next story is the latest scheme to cut our carbon emissions. And one of the options that scientists are looking into for alternative energy sources is the use of hydrogen.
Because hydrogen releases loads of energy when combined with oxygen, like combusted and everything.
Yep, exactly. And the product is the harmless substance water. However, getting enough hydrogen is the difficulty, as due to its extreme reactivity, there's very little free hydrogen available for us to use. Now, the new technology is the possibility of artificial leaves. Now, normally leaves use solar energy in photosynthesis to separate hydrogen from oxygen in water, which is the opposite process from combining the two in hydrogen combustion. Now, the artificial leaves would be designed to mimic this process with a feature allowing collection and storage of the hydrogen.
Okay, well, finally today, news has broken that following circumcision, the bacteria that like to live on the end of the penis change.
Oh, from what to what?
Well, in the intact penis and foreskin, there are often a lot of anaerobic bacteria. Now, that's bacteria that don't rely on oxygen to live. And these are fairly similar to the bacteria found in the vagina. But following circumcision, the same number of bacteria are present, but they actually change to a type of bacteria that live on the skin surface. Now, that's the kind that really do need oxygen to survive.
Okay, so what's the implications of this?
Well, as circumcision is known to approximately halve the risk of contracting HIV, it's thought that the reason for this radical finding might just be this change in the bacterial flora. And if that's the case, it might be possible to offer this 50% protection to men in a non-invasive and cheap manner if these bacterial populations could be manipulated to mimic the change seen after circumcision.
That's pretty interesting.
I thought so. So any comments or suggestions about that little lot, you know what to do. Send us an email to studio@shortscience.co.uk. Now it's time for this week's Capsule Science. So, with record-breaking snowfall in the UK this winter and the joys and the problems that that brings, we've been thinking about snow more than usual this year. So, this week, Emma is going to break down the science behind snow.
Okay, so, a relative of snow that we generally know more about, especially here in Britain, is rain. So, both snow and rain form from water vapour in the atmosphere. They're both entirely composed of water, just in different forms. So when water comes out of the atmosphere and out of the gaseous state into another state, such as liquid or solid, this is known as precipitation. As we know, there are many different types of precipitation, such as rain, snow, hail, etc. And different factors, such as temperature and pressure, affect how the water precipitates.
Okay, now, I want to tell you a little story about when I was a child, because they always go down very well. I always thought that snow clouds gradually filled up with snow, and that when they were full, they started to leak out snow. But it doesn't actually quite work like that, does it?
No, unfortunately, a snow cloud is not quite like a giant salt shaker full of ready-made snow, no matter how wonderful an image that is. The formation of snow begins when water vapour in the atmosphere is at a low temperature, and the water vapour becomes an ice crystal. It's called supercooling. Now, this forms a nucleus, and when more water vapour comes into contact with this nucleus, that then freezes onto the surface, and that allows the ice crystal to grow. Now, as more of these crystals develop, they start to reflect light in a different way, and they become visible in large clusters, so i.e. we can now see a snow cloud. So the crystals become larger and larger, and because of the hexagonal nature of the ice crystals, so they usually form a hexagonal shape because the lattice of ice is hexagonal.
Okay, so if they usually form a hexagonal shape, what other different shapes can they form?
Well, some aren't actually perfectly regular, even though we often see them as perfect in pictures and stuff. And there are some snowflakes which are either 3- or 12-sided, and that's simply half or double the normal hexagonal shape. But I was quite surprised that there can be triangular snowflakes. But the formation of snowflakes is variable, the shape, depending on air temperature, pressure, and how saturated with water the air is.
So that's your snowflake, and then it just falls to the ground then?
Well, not quite yet. The lattice is still really ice. However, it becomes heavy enough that it starts to fall towards the Earth. Now, on the way down, they encounter warmer air, because obviously it's colder at higher altitudes. This makes them partially melt, giving that characteristic fluffy snow texture. Now, the lattice structure and partial melting also encourage snowflakes to become attracted to each other and stick together, which is why you can sometimes see such enormous snowflakes. Therefore, the snow's not really completely formed until it's almost finished falling.
Okay, but we get all sorts of different types of snow. So, I mean, for our experience of snow when it's on the ground. So what's the difference between, like, pretty little snowflake snow and tiny little pellets of hard, cold, icy snow and the kind of wet snow that just makes you feel really awful? I mean, do they all come from different types of cloud, or is it about the air temperature then?
Well, as I said, different formations of snow are mostly to do with air temperature and humidity. For instance, there's this thing called grauple, which is a type of snow, more like sleet, that falls in the form of a ball rather than a flake, and it's more ice-like, so that's sort of that harder, icy snow. And that's due to there being so much water vapour condensing onto the surface of the flake that the shape's totally lost and just becomes a ball. And in addition, the snow can become an icy pellet if it melts too much and then refreezes as it falls, so it's no longer that nice, fluffy snow texture.
Okay, so what about the snow when it's actually on the ground then?
Well, once on the ground, snow then falls into many categories, and the fluffy snow that's made up of freshly fallen snowflakes, and that's the one we've been seeing here on large green spaces, and it's soft and powdery with lots of air between the spaces. But in places where the snow lasts longer, it can melt and refreeze to become more packed, and then it can also become icy or slushy.
Okay, I've got a couple of last questions about snow.
Go for it.
Why is snow white?
Okay, the water in crystalline form reflects light, which bounces off all the other crystals, and so the entire spectrum of light is reflected back. So if none of the light is absorbed, no wavelengths of light, that means that the light stays white and we see the snow as colourless, and colourless is white.
Okay, and on a slightly related colour issue, is there such a thing as a snowbow if it's sunny and snowing?
Well, I've been looking around a bit, and I mean, the way rainbows work, so related, is that water droplets, so the rain, allows light to pass through them, but the light becomes refracted, and so the different colours are refracted to a different extent. So snow reflects light rather than refracting. Also, the shape isn't droplet-like, and it won't create that rainbow arch. So I'm really sorry to break it to you, but snowbows don't really happen.
Okay, well, thanks for all your hard work there. Some interesting information. Now, I was wondering last night, because seeing all the snow was melting outside my house, whether the snowy weather was over. And I did a lot of research online, and many of the official weather websites were assuring me that the snow was, in fact, over. And apparently this was due to an anticyclone over Scandinavia that was going to move down over Central Europe and hence end the cold and snowy weather. And then I woke up this morning
and everything was covered in snow.
In fact, only Google Weather was correct last night in predicting snow. So,
and then we had to struggle in through the snow to get here.
I know. And so the trains had just got back to normal.
Yeah.
And then this morning, like, I waited on the station and they were all cancelled and it was a nightmare.
Yeah.
So we were thinking, why is Britain, as everybody is, so rubbish at snow? Connor, do you have any thoughts about this?
For me, Britain is just like the rest of us, really, when it comes to snow. It's the same like in Ireland. We're not used to it. It happens once a year. Okay. You know? Personally, I don't think it would be worthwhile our local authorities spending tons and tons of money to get all the specialist trucks and stuff and use them 1 week a year.
Yeah, because I guess, like, we look at cities like New York that have snow every year, and it snows there, and their snowplows come out, they clear the streets, the pavements are, you know, cleared properly.
Salted and gritted.
Everybody goes about their normal business, and it's nice. And as tourists, we go to New York and we enjoy the snow there, and it doesn't seem to, you know, paralyse life like it does here.
Yeah, and if you go to mountain resorts and stuff, and all their buildings are properly insulated and it's warm inside, and you don't even have to have the heating blasting out, and they're just really prepared for it.
Yeah, and I suppose because, like you said, Connor, we only have snow maybe a couple of days a year. I mean, this year has been exceptional. We've had it just before Christmas and again now, and it's lasted over a week now.
Yeah.
But it would require quite a big investment for Britain to become snow savvy. I mean, we would need big stockpiles of grit, because I guess they probably have, you know, enough to grit for 2 or 3 days or at a time.
Yeah.
And we're now past a week, so that's why all the grit was running out. And they'd just need so much more equipment, and they'd need to upgrade the trains because clearly they can't cope with...
Yeah, because all the technology's there, isn't it? Because people do cope with snow all the time in those countries where they have it. But, you know, are we ready to invest in the technology that... we're only going to use a few days a year, unless it's 2010.
I was quite surprised that the Eurostar was so badly affected, because I always thought that's like much more modern technology, and I thought if only our trains were like Eurostar trains, but actually,
yeah, they
Eurostar
seem to have failed
as
well,
down
spectacularly.
As well.
Yeah, that was a shocker. But to be honest with you, I was kind of, it's a very British attitude that I find, as you know, as a foreigner here, that British people who were in Paris a week before Christmas. They're stuck in the train station and they're going on the radio here complaining, saying it's terrible. This is absolutely... You're stuck in Paris. It's a nice place to be stuck. You know, you've got a whole week. You'll get back in time for Christmas. Just enjoy Paris in the snow. Come on, people, please.
So it was quite interesting. That week before Christmas when we had the terrible snow on the Monday and the Tuesday, I was coming home from work both evenings, and on the Monday... I got to the train station, it was snowing, and everyone's like, wow, it's snowing, it's amazing. And the trains were delayed like 4 hours, and everyone was like standing there, and people were, you know, cheering when the trains came in and helping people. And it was absolutely packed and manic and horrid, but everyone was really nice.
And now everyone's fed up, right?
But by the Tuesday, yeah. People were throwing things at the trains when they came in. People were swearing at people. They were shouting at everyone, and it was really, really scary. And they brought riot police in, and it was just a totally different atmosphere. And I just don't think we have any generosity towards, you know, difficult circumstances. We
I know
expect
this
everything
morning,
to be normal.
This morning,
not.
I kind of expected everyone to be saying, oh, you know, it's the snow, let's all be, you know, nice to our fellow travellers, and yeah, the train's going to be crowded because all the ones behind us are cancelled. But people were being really quite, you know, obnoxious, yeah.
I just don't think we have the patience for it. I think people in New York, okay, they have better facilities and they maybe have better, like, you know, the councils or whatever clear the streets and it's all much easier for them. I think they are actually better spirited towards it as well, maybe because we don't have enough experience of it ourselves, and maybe it's not just
yeah we think we deserve about 1 or 2 days a year, you know, on Christmas, and then that's it.
Yeah. Okay, well, I think we're gonna have to draw a close to this very politically sided conversation now. So if you have any questions about anything that Emma has been telling us, or if you'd like to suggest a capsule science topic for another week, then please get your laptop open, your typing fingers poised, and send us an email to studio@shortscience.co.uk. So now it's time for us to meet this week's guest, Connor Walsh, an independent radio producer. So hello, Connor.
Hello, Elizabeth. How are you?
I'm doing great, thanks. Thank you ever so much for braving the weather and coming along to the studio today.
Oh, no, it's great. I had to play around in Hyde Park before I came in. It was lovely.
It's probably the best thing to do in this weather, I think.
Yeah, you've got to take advantage and just go and play.
Exactly.
Okay, so now you work as an independent radio producer. So tell us a bit about what that involves and a bit about your background.
Well, my background in radio has mostly been in state-run public radio stations. I started in 2003 in China Radio International. That was in Beijing, and I got there because in the previous millennium, I went to SOAS, also in the University of London, studied Chinese, and then afterwards went to work in Beijing and doing radio in English because I had a Chinese degree, of course.
of course.
Naturally, and I left that and I went off to... the BBC Chinese service, and I've worked in a few other radio stations since then. That's brought me sort of with a quick wander around the world, has brought me full circle, and I'm working in London Chinese Radio, which is an online community radio station for Chinese people in London.
Okay, so tell us a bit about your current project there.
Well, we're doing starting a couple of shows, and one of them is a health programme. The idea about this program is to provide practical information for people who have moved to the UK and they're just not sure about how the NHS works, or they're not sure what services are available, what they'll have to pay for, things like that.
Yeah.
So we're going to have that. That's going to be one part of the program. The other part of the program is also going to appeal to a lot, we think, of Chinese students in the UK, because a lot of the people that I meet doing this are science students.
Mm.
So we want to keep people up to date on medical research, the biological sciences and developments that are happening here in the UK. We are London Chinese Radio. We're not an international radio station. We're focused on what's happening in the UK. And that's what we're looking at investigating and spreading the word about.
So presumably the programming on London Chinese Radio is in Chinese languages.
Yeah, we're very broad-minded about defining Chinese. Obviously, I'm not exactly Chinese myself. But, you know, I've lived in China, I speak Chinese, so I fit in. That's part of the deal. And some of our other presenters are likewise. We have a journalist from Time Out China. He does this underground Chinese music show, for instance. So, but we also have a lot of Mandarin speakers. Most of our presenters speak Mandarin Chinese. We also have Cantonese. Mm. And we have British-born Chinese people who will speak a little bit of both but prefer to speak English. It's a very broad sense of Chinese community.
OK, so tell us a little bit about the radio station itself, because obviously we're broadcasting from a student radio station here. So what are the sort of differences? What's the setup that you've got there at London Chinese Radio?
Our setup is, in some ways, it's quite similar. You know, it's a small studio operation with a group of core volunteers. And the whole thing is a voluntary organisation. We have occasionally charities and foundations will give money for an employed member of staff for a few months. But we're working away and we produce these programmes. People who have never made radio before come along and we show them how to make radio, and we give them all the facilities, we give them a website to put it on. We also have people who've worked in Chinese media and who are really good radio producers, some of them, and people who work in TV. So it's this very sort of open-minded thing, and you get in touch with us, you ask to come on board, and we say yes, because we facilitate people that way.
Great stuff. Now, I just wondered, you talk about working for various sort of state-run radio stations. Is there a difference or a difference in the experience for you in working in China in sort of state-run radio and then working in something like the BBC?
Crikey.
Without politically shooting yourself, obviously.
In a word, yes. In China, it's a propaganda machine. Broadcasting internationally is soft power. So it's an idea of projecting information about yourself and getting beyond political news. Now, that's what the BBC World Service is for as well. And the BBC World Service is probably the greatest example of soft power in the world, because people almost all over the world trust it. The power it's showing is not, here's what the British government says. Far from it. It's saying the British government allows people to speak freely and to investigate the news freely. In China Radio International, it's the opposite.
Mm.
The stories are ridiculous. We could talk about the weather, the very opposite of snow. In Beijing, it gets very, very hot in the summer.
Mm.
Back when I was there 10 years ago, there was a rule that if it went above 37 degrees, everyone could go home. Didn't have to go to work. It was too dangerous. The air conditioning would cost too much, whatever.
Yeah.
So the official weather forecast never went above 37 degrees.
Yeah.
And I had a colleague once, and he was going live on air. He was an Australian. He was new in town, didn't know about this, waiting for the weather forecast, and the editor was doing something else that wouldn't give it to him. So my colleague went to the BBC website, which you could then get in China. 39 degrees. The temperature in Beijing today, 39 degrees. Wouldn't that be nice today? He got a very stern talking to.
I can imagine.
Yeah.
Oh dear. Wow.
Well, thanks very much for talking to us today. It's been lovely to hear from you. Now it's time for Capsule Medicine.
So, with all this talk and experience of snow, Elizabeth is going to tell us a bit about the impact of the cold conditions on our bodies.
Okay, well, we all know about getting cold hands from snowball fights and building snowmen, and how painful it can be as our hands warm up again. But when does actual damage start to occur to our tissues? Now, Emma, what conditions can you think of that are to do with cold exposure?
Frostbite, and, you know, in the olden days, they were always talking about chilblains.
That's right. Now, several conditions can result from this cold. Now, the most minor of them is something called frostnip. Now, this is a superficial cooling of body tissue without any permanent damage occurring. So this might be the state of your nose after a walk in the icy winds of winter, or your hands after a bit of snow sculpture. Now, moving up in seriousness, we then have chilblains. Now, these are painful little ulcers that occur on repeated exposure to cold conditions, particularly on the hands and the feet.
Yeah, I did think chilblains was something that only really happened back in the day.
Well, no, you can still get them.
Well, obviously our bodies.
Yeah, I mean, I'm
still the same, I guess.
I've been prone to a few chilblains in my time. Now, they are actually acral ulcers. Now, that means that they're ulcers affecting the extremities. And they occur when a predisposed individual is exposed to cold and humidity. And they can often be triggered by sort of rapid changes between cold and warm. So, for example, if you've got very cold feet and you put a hot water bottle in bed, or you rest your feet on the radiator, you can sort of get yourself into trouble that way. Now, the cold exposure damages capillary beds in the skin. Now, this in turn causes redness, itching, blisters and inflammation. And it's one of those tricky things that itches really badly, and when you try and scratch it, it's really painful.
Lovely.
Now, they were obviously more common in times gone by when, without central heating, you could get mighty cold feet at night. Now, if you're prone to chilblains, now, in modern times, with central heating and everything, it could be a sign of an underlying medical condition, so it's best to get it checked out by your doctor.
Okay, so capillary damage, that is fairly near the surface and pretty minor sounding. So what's the next step in cold damage?
Well, more serious cold damage to the extremities is actual frostbite. Now, this can particularly affect people with diabetes or with neurological problems, as they don't feel the condition starting and take preventive action. Now, because they've got nerve damage and things, they just don't have the sensation of cold that the rest of us have that would tell us to put gloves on. And this also affects people with poor circulation.
So what's poor circulation got to do with getting frostbite?
Well, it's our blood that carries warmth throughout our bodies, and we are warmest in the centre of our bodies at our core, and our blood carries this warmth out to the extremities like our noses, hands and feet. Without this blood flow, heat would be progressively lost to the environment, and in cold conditions, problems like frostbite would set in.
Okay, so how do you know when frostbite is taking hold?
Well, the first stage is when the skin goes a nasty yellow-white colour. Sort of colour that just looks like trouble. Now, this is because so much heat is being lost through the skin that the blood vessels are closing down and they're preventing adequate warming blood flow to the tissue.
But you just said that it's the blood flow that protects the tissue from getting cold, so why would the body direct blood away? Surely it should send more blood to the cold bits.
Well, that would be nice and it would prevent frostbite, but sadly, we'd then die from hypothermia. See, the body has to prioritise. The main priority is maintaining our core body temperature. Now, that's pretty much the temperature on the inside of our torso where most of our vital organs are holed up. So if too much blood is being cooled peripherally, our core temperature would start to drop. So our bodies make the decision to protect our core at the expense of our extremities.
Ah, so what happens after the colour change?
Well, that colour change to white-yellow is really the last chance to prevent permanent damage. Gently warming the tissue at that point could still stop frostbite proper setting in. You also tend to get a lot of burning sensations at this sort of first degree stage. The next thing, second degree frostbite. Now, this occurs when the tissue becomes very red and painful. And even if you treated the condition at this stage, the skin would blister and peel off.
Well, first degree, second degree, sounds like burns. Is there going to be a third degree stage?
There is indeed. And at this stage, the skin actually dies. It becomes waxy and hard and the tissue may swell up. Now, immediate treatment at this stage is required to prevent permanent nerve damage and even auto-amputation of the dead tissue. Now, that's when if you got frostbite in your finger and it went all dead and then it would just drop off by itself. Now, as there's no feeling in damaged tissue, you have to be extra, extra careful to check for cuts and grazes, because if, for example, you're trekking across the Arctic and you get frostbite and you can't feel your finger and then you cut it and then you get an infection, you would get gangrene and then you would potentially have devastating need for limb amputation or even death.
Oh dear, so if we're going to try and prevent that happening, what's the treatment for frostbite?
Well, the person needs to be in stable, warm conditions. If tissue's warmed up and then it refreezes, so for example, if you're still trekking across the Arctic and you warm something up and then it refreezes, the damage can be much, much worse. But if you're now indoors and the tissue can be gradually warmed, then that's okay. It's really important that you don't rub or manipulate frozen tissue to bring it back to life, because ice crystals may form in the tissue, and by manipulating them physically, you can actually create more injury.
Well, that's fascinating, if gruesome stuff, but I'm going to have to stop you there. Now, if you have any questions or comments about this week's Capsule Medicine, please chuck an email our way at studio@shortscience.co.uk, and we'll do our best to answer your questions.
Now it's time for our weekly quiz, the bit of the show where we get to embarrass each other terribly.
And ourselves.
Yeah, and we're going to be starting our quiz afresh for 2010. So we all know, I think, that I did rather badly compared to the combined forces of Georgie and Emma. And we're going to write that off. We're not going to announce a winner. I mean, that just wouldn't be relevant or interesting to anybody, I don't think. So we're going to have a fresh quiz starting from now. Score is 0-0. Each week, Emma and I will ask each other three multiple choice questions loosely based on our topic. So I'm going to start this week, and Connor is going to help both of us out as and when he sees fit. So here is my first question for Emma. Question number one. Hypothermia is the medical name given to the condition resulting from a drop in the body temperature below A, 34 degrees, B, 35 degrees, or C, 36 degrees?
Ah, there you go. Now, we know hypothermia is a drop in the core body temperature, but, normal body temperature is 37 degrees.
So I was thinking 34 would mean you were dead.
Probably. Yeah. And I was thinking 36 seems quite close to 37, but then on the other hand, we do stay really quite the same due to homeostasis. So I got it there. But I'm not really sure whether 34, you're right, Connor, you probably would be dead. So is it 36 or is that slightly too close, and 35 is when you would get hypothermia? I don't know. I always think of hypothermia when you fall in cold water, which would just be really, really cold.
Yeah.
Okay, there's a lot of thinking going on here, not a lot of answering.
Okay.
I'm going to say my 35 is my bet, but okay, obviously Emma is free to make her own.
Right, let's go for 35 then.
You'd be correct, that's one
Yay!
Point to you. Now, as a point of interest, my body temperature is 36 degrees.
Really?
My normal. And it, cause
how
it,
do you know?
Well,
just by taking
on occasions when I've taken it, yeah.
Doctor,
yeah. For obvious, necessary reasons.
Yeah.
I don't know. Anyway, but no, because 37.5 is the average.
Yeah.
So there is quite a range in the population. And mine does tend to sit rather low.
Mm.
And you wouldn't be dead at 34. You can go down to 32 and below. Although, obviously, you'd start to lose organs like your brain.
Yeah.
So probably wouldn't want to.
Wow.
But,
blimey.
Anyway, go on then. Question
So 37.5 is the average. There you go. Right. Okay. So question one from me. Is what is the best snow to use for snowmen and snowballs? Is it A, powder snow, B, crust snow, or C, packing snow?
I was going to say skin tone snow, but that's the worst snow to use for anything, isn't it?
Well, you'd think packing snow because you'd pack it together and then it'd be hard. But does packing snow mean the snow that's already packed together and therefore is too hard to mould and wouldn't stick together, and therefore you need powder snow, which you can then pack, which would then become packing snow?
I'm going to say crust snow because it has a sort of a relative rigidity to it.
Guess so.
But would it mould well? Would you get bits
of crust
sticking out?
You don't really mould.
I'm saying nothing.
Oh, yeah, okay, yeah.
So I think crust snow is like the snow that's frozen and it's got that frozen layer on the top.
Yeah.
So I think that would be quite hard to make snowballs out, snowmen, you know, roll a snowball up. So I'm drawn to A or C, but...
Yeah, you've convinced me slightly as well.
I do that, but it doesn't mean I'm right. I can be ever so convincing, but wrong. It's a specialty I have.
I'm going to say packing snow.
Okay, I'm going to go with you. See, packing snow.
Yeah, you're right.
Yay!
And it just shows that when you know the answer, it's easy. Because I thought, oh, is that ridiculously easy? Because you obviously pack snow together. So apparently packing snow is... Because powder snow is quite fluffy and it just falls apart in your hands. So apparently packing snow is when the powder snow has just melted that little bit... And so it starts to all stick together better.
Yeah.
So apparently the best time to make a snowman is on a warm afternoon, just after a fresh snowfall.
Okay.
I think I'll go to the park and make a snowman right after this then.
Let's press on. Question number two for me. What is cold diuresis? Is it A, increased peeing in cold conditions, B, increased sweating in cold conditions, or C, increased evaporative fluid loss in cold conditions?
Now, I'm going to put myself out there and say, I think I know this one.
Because, you should know this one.
Because diuretic is all to do with the kidneys and urine and blah, blah, blah. So, and also, I happen to know that when it's cold, you do get that sensation. So, so I'm going to say, A, increased peeing in cold conditions.
Yes. Now, interesting. I haven't got very much time, but it's a very interesting story that I want to tell to do this. Well, it's not a story. It's fact. It's, you know, vital for people to know.
Yeah.
The reason why you pee more in cold weather, because
your
extremities are closed down, so therefore you have less pipe work open in your body to hold your blood volume. So therefore your blood volume is at an increased pressure.
So it wants to shrink.
So
you want to get rid of water.
It gets filtered more quickly and so you produce more pee.
There you go.
Boom, boom.
There you go.
Okay.
Right, my question number two. If it's sunny, snow doesn't necessarily melt, as anyone that's been skiing on a sunny day knows. Why is that? Is it A, the air temperature is still cold, B, the sun's reflected off the snow, or C, the snow retains cold air between the flakes?
All three, I would imagine.
That's what I was thinking. This is a hard question.
Okay, let's go for the main one. Because, they are all pretty plausible. So,
I think the air temperature is still cold because you still need to wear ski clothes when you go skiing. You don't just wear a bikini.
That's true. Although I have seen people wearing bikini skiing.
Okay. and I think I don't think it's the sun being reflected. I think that is a red herring more.
Mm.
It probably helps, but I don't think it's the main reason.
Yeah, I'm verging towards the air being held between the flakes.
Yeah. I think I'll go with that one. C. Snow retains cold air.
Well, the main one I was going for was that the sun is reflected off the snow because literally it can be really sunny and get... I mean, obviously, if it gets too warm, the snow will melt. But because the sun is completely reflected off the snow, it doesn't really absorb any of the energy. So it doesn't melt. So there you go. That's it. It's B.
I always lose at this. Okay. Question
Lisbeth's
number...
having a stop.
I'm not at all a bad loser, really. Question three. What is the Osborne wave? Is this A, classic EEG finding of hypothermia? So that's a brainwave reading. A classic
You clarified that for me.
A classic ECG finding of hypothermia.
That's
hot. A hot reading. Or a classic ocular movement associated with hypothermia. An ocular eye.
Yeah. Right, okay, so EEG, I've been reminded, is the brain. Right, no idea. There's wave activity for brains, for hearts. I'm going to go for ECG because it might affect the heart when you're cold.
I'm going to say it's probably not an ECG.
Okay.
Because if the ECG is that, how would you fit a wave on an ECG? They're just kind of aligned with some spikes and stuff. I don't think you could
fit
a wave in there.
That's true. I don't know.
So I'm going to say EEG.
Okay. All right. Okay. We're going for one each, so you can tell us which is right.
Okay, well, it is actually the ECG.
Oh, there you go.
So you do get all sorts of waves on the ECG. I know it looks like spikes, but there's all sorts of things to do with different things. You have delta waves, Osborne waves. It's just the little curves and bumps that you can get in between the spikes.
There you go.
Okay, so last question.
Right, last question. From 1950 to 2006, because apparently that's the last data available, what was the percentage of years that London had seen a white Christmas? Is it A, 12%, B, 6%, or C, 23%?
I don't think it's going to be very high. What do you reckon, Connor?
Yeah. Still 1950, you know, they talk about the old days always having white Christmases, don't they? What was that? 20 what? 20...
12, 6 or 23?
I want to say 23. I don't think it's right, but I want to say it.
Am I going to go with that one?
It's 26 years. I mean, 56 years.
okay. C 23%.
C 23%.
Yeah.
It is, in fact, B 6%. Only 6% of years have seen an actual white Christmas. So there you go.
Oh, so this is rubbish. The score to me is 1 out of 3 and 3 out of 3 for Emma.
No,
was it 3?
Surely. Was it 3?
Yeah, you did get 3.
Oh, it's 3.
You got. Yay. You said ECG. Mm. You said, peeing. Yeah, you did get 3.
Okay. Oh.
So we'll pick up this battle again next week when I'm sure I'll do a little bit better. But for now, it's time to announce this week's science trivia question for you at home to solve.
That is right. So here is the trivia question for this week. Which chemical element has the shortest name? Now that's name, as in not like the symbol, the name, the actual name.
Okay, so if you know the answer, please drop us an email to studio@shortscience.co.uk and you could find yourself the proud winner of a Short Science fridge magnet. Now, Connor, we've got just like a minute left. Do you want to say anything about how people can get in touch with you if they're interested in London Chinese radio?
Absolutely. If you are a medical student or a health professional, or if you want to reach Chinese health professionals and research students, then just get in touch with us, londonchineseradio.com. You can leave a comment there and I will get back to you straight away because I really want to get more input from professional scientists for this radio show.
Brilliant. So we'll also put a link to that on our website, which is www.shortscience.co.uk.
Groovy.
Great. So that's all we've got time for today. But before we sign off, if you've got any comments or questions, don't forget to email us at studio@shortscience.co.uk.
So, you can also listen to the show again from the Imperial College Radio website at www.icradio.com, and tomorrow the podcast will be out and available for download. You can subscribe to us via iTunes, just search for Short Science or follow the link from our website, and alternatively you can subscribe with any number of podcatchers by following the subscribe link on our podcast page.
So, thank you very much for listening. This has been Short Science. Our guest today was Connor Walsh. The presenters were Emma Berger and myself, Elizabeth Hawke. The production was done by our own good selves. The theme tune was written and produced by Don Gould of Music by Design.
Thanks for listening, and we'll be back at the same time next week for another episode of Short Science.
Ascoltando i podcast di Radio Bue, la web radio degli studenti dell'Università di Padova, www.radiobue.it.